والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me anyway, and that's when faith begins.
You kill in the name of freedom. You kill in the name of democracy. You kill in the name of God. But not in my name will you kill. Is it not enough what you've done? With all the bloodshed you've caused, yet your greed drives you on. In your brutal race for acquisition, no land is left untouched, driven by a vile ambition to have the whole world in your clutch. Every single new addition to your slave colony does nothing to dull your ambition to leave no nation free. It is indeed a sad condition that you suffer from, this itching desire for prime position to have all under your thumb. Not in my name will you fight. Not in my name will you kill. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name will you love. Not in my name will you invade. Not in my name will you pray? Not in my name will you terrorize. Not in my name will you lie. Take heed. One day you'll find yourself pursued by every person you've made bleed. You thought they'd been subdued. You were wrong. You were wrong. They've been freed. They've been freed. Against your evil methods of violence and intimidation, against your hijacking and misinterpretation of my peaceful faith and revelation, I shout with billions in this demonstration. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name. to speak again. No, then I'll
Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to Iran Radio from the vibrant capital of Tehran. And we are here to share more programs that inspire and connect. Let's dive into the next batch of our programs this hour. Our next program is For Humanity, Bridging Faith and the Human Experience. This program covers a variety of subjects concerning human beings in the Noble Quran, including individual and social issues. Subjects like the family and how to interact with other faithful Muslims are explored from the profound perspective of the Holy Quran. Then we have Ulama's speech sharing the profound wisdom of top scholars. This program broadcasts excerpts from the Farsi and Arabic voices of well-known and reputable Islamic and Shia scholars and authorities, complete with English translation. It's a unique opportunity to learn from the masters. Next, enjoy another segment of our diverse radio programs. Following that, A to Z of Life is here to inspire your Islamic lifestyle, hosted by Sister Zainab James. This program presents an Islamic-Iranian lifestyle in a variety of engaging ways. Utilizing ayahs from the Holy Quran and Hadith, as well as inspirational poetry, parables, and stories. After this, we'll hear For Humanity.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program For Humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic elements pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard, titled A 250-Year-Old Person or A 250-Year-Old Man, which is a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the life stories and biographies of the great leaders of Islam, the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the successors of the Prophet from among his pure progeny. So we were talking about the challenges that the Prophet ﷺ had throughout his years as the leader of the community, and also his personal characteristics. And we talked about the triumphant return of the Prophet to the Mecca and how he showed love and forgiveness, not just by words, but by actions, especially when he was the most powerful person. He forgave all those people who had killed his close relatives, like his uncle Hamza and other people. And he taught Muslims for eternity that forgiveness comes before everything else. Now, another incident that took place in the final year of the Prophet of Islam was the incident of Ghadir al-Khum. Now, the incident of Ghadir has one Shi'i aspect that in Shia Islam is studied, but because it's an incident in the life of the Prophet of Islam, Muslims cannot just ignore it in general. And it has a role to play for the overall ideology of Islam. Now, before the Ghadir, we should contextualize, we should put in context Ghadir. Before the Ghadir, the Prophet of Islam, he performed Hajjatul Wida, the last Hajj performed by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And in that Hajj, in that pilgrimage to Mecca, the Prophet of Islam taught Muslims everything they needed about the rituals of the pilgrimage. And in Mina, in one of the ritualistic stays throughout the process of Hajj, he delivered two sermons. Okay, there is the Sermon of Mina, but the most accurate account is that he delivered two sermons in Mina, one on around the day 10th of the Hajjah, and the other after Ayyam al-Tashriq, which would be around the 13th of the Hajjah. Okay, so, and we analyze, when we analyze these two sermons, we realize that it has a great political and social connotation in it. And these sermons have been transmitted in both Shia and Sunni sources of hadith. So he starts talking about jihad, about the struggles in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he would say that the struggle against pagans continues until that everyone accepts monotheism. And this is not just a matter of like temporary matter. The struggle continues as long as there is oppression. The struggle continues as long as there are ideologies that would enslave people. Pagan ideologies are like that. Pagan ideologies are the basis for the enslavement and oppression against people. And if you remember, in one episode we said that all the oppressions and all the injustice throughout history, they originate from wrong ideologies. And when we talk about Tawheed, we want to ultimately establish justice, because everything else other than true Tawheed would enable and would justify oppression and injustice. Okay, we're going to have a break and we come back to continue the discussion. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Welcome back. We were talking about the sermons of Mina delivered by the Prophet, and this is For Humanity from IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to your program. Now, the topics that the Prophet covers in the Sermon of Mina, we said that one of them was the struggle. The next is the unity among Muslims, that Muslims should not engage in civil war, that the sanctity of the blood of a Muslim is emphasized there. This is a people that it was possible that they would immediately go back to their default tribal system, okay? Because I'm from this tribe, you're from that tribe, you have a fort. No. According to Islam, all Muslims are equal, and you do not have the right to start a rage war based on those things. So, about the values of the era of ignorance, era of Jahiliyyah. Now, this is a challenge that the revolutions have, that after a while, people start going backward, irtija or irtidad. They start going back to the values of the era of the pre-revolution era, okay? And for the people of Arabian Peninsula, it was very possible that this short time, although the Prophet spent a lot of energy and time educating educating people, teaching them about the values of Islam and everything, still it was possible that they forget. If you have been trained and raised in an environment for 40 years and those habits and customs and values that have persisted over centuries, right? So it's very difficult to change them in a matter of 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. So that's why the Prophet would always leave a mark that you should not go back. You should not. And the values of the era of Jahiliya are all under my feet. The values based on, I don't know, tribal affiliation, about the financial positions of people and everything. أَلَا وَكُلُّ مَأْثَرَةٍ فِي الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ تَحْتَ قَدَمَيْ هَاتَيْنِ. Anything remaining from the era of Jahiliya are under my feet. They have no value. Now we have set a new system of value in Islam, which is based on piety, which is based on obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And those privileges, those things that you thought if you're born in this tribe, you have privileges. And in our time, you would say sometimes these things exist. Like, for example, if you're from that nation, by default, people respect you more. If you're from that, I don't know, community, you have more chances of having a job. If you're, no, all of these are wrong. All of these are new forms of Jahiliyyah and the era of ignorance, tribal affiliations or tribal mentality in a different form, in the name of nationalism or in the name of other things. People should only be valued based on their performance, based on things that is under their control, not the things that are out of their control. Okay, so this is just some of the topics covered in the sermon of Mina. Inshallah, in the next episode, we're going to cover other topics that the Prophet ﷺ talks about in the sermon of Mina. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Ilm fiqh az ulum sharifiyye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
تنزل الملائکه و روح روح سوال میکنن روح میگه روح فرشته است که بالاتر از بقیه فرشته است.
The angels and the spirit or ruh descend. They ask about the spirit or ruh. The spirit is an angel who is higher than the other angels, meaning higher than Gabriel, Israel, Michael, and other angels. The angels and the spirit descend therein by permission of the Lord for every matter. Their descent is by the permission of their Lord, for every matter means they descend to carry out every affair. The angels descend to carry out every affair. The night of Qadr is a night when man is the link between earth and heaven. Our deeds go to heaven and the angels come to earth. The angels and the spirit descend therein by permission of their Lord for every matter. The angels descend.
از امام صادق پرسیدن روح همون جبرئیله، فرمود جبرئیل از ملائکه است.
امام صادق علیه السلام was asked, is this spirit the same as Gabriel? He said, Gabriel is from the angels. The spirit, or a ruh, is superior to the angels. When he recited this verse, he said, the angels and the spirit descend. He mentioned the name spirit, it means the ruh, separately. Things whose names are mentioned separately mean their rank is higher. For example, nusuk means worship. Manasik al-hajj means the rites of hajj. Well, prayer is also a form of worship, but God mentions the name of prayer or salat separately. He says, indeed, my prayer, and then says, and my worship, meaning, O God, my prayer and my worship. Well, prayer is worship, but he mentions the name of prayer separately. You're hosting a gathering. At a gathering where an important personality is present, you say, you, please come. Then you say, so-and-so is also coming. What does this mean? It means they are also a guest, but their status is separate from ordinary guests. Indeed, my prayer. Then I say, and my worship. Here too, it is al-malaika, the angels, but the angels and the spirit or ruh descend. The account of the spirit or ruh is really separate. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening through the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Just to know you, whoever you are, love with you, learn from you, open to you my heart. Soon when I say goodbye, move on. I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return. While I'm here, kind of neighbor who prays for you and me, the kind of neighbor who prays for you and me, there for you, a shoulder to turn to. I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return. Pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Been a pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Remember me, so I might be with you. I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return, waiting to return, waiting to return, return.
Welcome back to The Voice of War. My guest today is Professor Ilan Pape, one of the most prominent and provocative historians of the modern Middle East. He is the director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and is best known for his groundbreaking work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including his books The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Lobbying for Zionism. His latest book, Israel on the Brink, offers a sobering diagnosis of what he sees as seven internal cracks threatening the future of the Israeli state, while also tracing the deeper historical, ideological, and geopolitical forces that have shaped its path. Ilan, thank you very much for joining me on The Voices of War.
It's a great pleasure to be on The Voice of War in the program. Thank you very much for having me. Great.
It's been a long time coming, so I'm very grateful that we finally be able to lock it in. Maybe we can start straight away with your most recent book, Israel on the Brink. In it, you open up by saying Israel's demise is inevitable, not because you're a determinist, but because the process is already in motion. So what signs of this internal unraveling do you see most clearly?
Yeah, I think each process that I identify in the book by itself is not powerful enough either to bring a regime change or disintegration or a fall. I mean, I'm not a prophet, so I don't know exactly what will happen. But I do feel that the structure that is a state and ideological project is collapsing. Very important one is the internal implosion from within the Israeli Jewish society, and this goes to one of the two basic challenges Zionism had. One, and we'll talk about it a bit later, is the challenge of imposing a European state on the Arab world at the expense of a local indigenous Palestinian people. But the other challenge, and that's what is really part of the internal implosion is all about in Israel, is the challenge of defining a religion as nationalism, defining Judaism as nationalism and not as a religion. And it took time, and now it's very clear that this is not an intellectual debate. What does it mean to be a Jew state? What does it mean to be a Jew in Israel? It became a struggle for life and death between those who thought that Judaism can be equated with pluralism, liberal practices, democracy, and so on, be that as it may, only for the Jews, not for the Palestinians, or those who say, no, if it's a Jewish state, then it's a theocracy. Then it is a messianic state. Then it is loyal to everything that they read in the Bible, everything that they read in the sacred writings or books that were published after the Bible. Kind of what we call the halacha in Jewish. The halacha is like the Sharia. It's the kind of the law, the Jewish law state. As I said, this is not academic. That means that it defines the public space, it defines the laws of the land. It also defines the attitude towards the Palestinians, and not only the Palestinians, but also to the neighboring Arab state, because this particular version that has been developed and now is tearing the Jewish society apart from within is also messianic. So they believe that they have an historical opportunity to rebuild probably a kingdom that never existed. Because it's all a fable, the kingdom of Solomon and David. But they want to recreate it, and it extends even beyond Palestine. So that's one very powerful process. As I say, not by itself leading to collapse, but with the other, it's very powerful.
Mm.
And there is a dynamic here. Because this is the trajectory, because this is the orientation of the Israeli Jewish society, it increases the isolation of Israel in the world. Israel is losing its traditional allies. And now it's very clear that the civil society regards Israel as a pariah state, but it will, I believe, eventually affect governments and political elites, and even economic elites, not for moral reasons, but because it would not be a very good place to invest money. So you have the isolation from the outside. You also have a Palestinian society that, yes, right now is led by a very fragmented, disunited, and not very capable political elite, but it's a very young society. And as I show in the book, the younger generation is far more united, assertive, knowledgeable, and I do believe it will have its say in the future, and it would not use the same kind of diplomacy and tactic as the present political elite. It would be much more devoted, I think, to liberation and decolonization, and would ask the world to support that kind of a Palestinian position. So with the other two processes I described, this may be more possible. It's not possible now to enlist the world, let's say the world's support for the idea of a one state or a decolonized Palestine, but if the two other processes that I'm describing would indeed develop, then it is possible. This also goes along with a very deep economic crisis. Israel is now preparing itself for decades of war economy. War economies can survive 3, 4, 5 years. They cannot survive a decade. So I foresee a very deep economic crisis as well that would depend very much on the American taxpayer. And I don't think either Republicans or Democrats in the distant future would continue to be so generous with the money of the American taxpayer. And to that, I would add, and with this I would finish, and just to give a bit of a display here, the disassociation of Jews, especially young Jews, from the idea of Zionism in Israel. Israel is losing the younger Jewish generation, especially in the United States. And without that kind of support, you remain depending on material interests and not, moral interests. And I don't know how long can a regime rely only on material, economic, and military interests to sustain a state for a very long time. Not only it's not a matter that the state disappears; states don't disappear. But to keep the people that you need to maintain a state in a war economy, isolation, a pariah state, where the Jews in the world do not support you, would be very, very difficult in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to pivot back to that first point, and that's the internal fractures that you've described inside Israel itself. I mean, what we see in the West, and you know this far better than I do, is that we get the impression that the society is cohesive as a whole, and it's popular support for the Gaza war in particular, and also for what's happening in the West Bank. And you also draw the distinction in the book between the state of Judea and the state of Israel. So can you just give us a little bit more insight into what you mean by this internal fracture, and how much that actually has, how much of a chance that actually have, to bring about some change in the Israeli government?
Yeah. We have to look at it the other way around, in a way. The idea in Israel was that whatever are the internal dissent or disagreements, there is a common enemy. And in the time that you face the common enemy, all the disagreements are forgotten and we're all united. Now, this may be true for the short wars that Israel had, 6 days war, 3 weeks war in 1973. No, this cannot, when we see it's happening, folding in front of our eyes, this kind of unity cannot be held for 2 years. So to begin with, yes, there was a total support for everyone in the Jewish society for the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip as a reaction to the 7th of October 2023 Hamas attack. But then all the dissent and conflict, the internal conflict, that preceded the 7th of October, by which you had two entities, and I will describe them in a minute, fighting for the whole, everything that the state can offer in terms of institutions and powers, that internal conflict reappeared about 6 or 7 months into the war. So for half a year, you had a sense of a cohesion. And it affected, the dissent affected every aspect. Maybe this is not reported enough in the world, but even on the issue of the hostages, a certain camp, which I call the State of Judea, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, the State of Judea was not that concerned about the fate of the hostages because they belonged to the other camp, the liberal, secular camp. So they showed no much compassion for them.
These are people from the kibbutzim, etc., right?
Yeah, exactly. People who are gathered to be the left of Israel. They're the ones who mostly were either killed or abducted. And they were attacked. The families were attacked as traitors and as undermining the military effort. So the cohesion isn't there anymore. It wasn't there. The war or the genocide or the operation, call it what you want, cannot gloss over the kind of division that occurred, I would say, at the beginning of this century, between what I call the State of Judea, that is a group, an ideological movement that grew in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank and gained more and more support among the less well-off sections of the Israeli society, mainly people from originally from North African Jewish origin, and from Orthodox and traditional Jewish people, creating this vision of a state that is run by religious law, that does not need democracy, nor does it have any inhibitions in dealing with the Palestinians and even with the Arab neighbors, recreating this ancient kingdom that everybody would respect and fear, not only in Palestine, but all over the Arab world. And luckily, there are these populist allies like Trump, populist fascist leaders in Europe, Modi in India, and so on. So they didn't even feel that they were isolated internationally, not to mention that some of the Arab rulers were very willing to go along with this kind of a vision of a future. The state of Israel is the old state, the one that tried unsuccessfully, tried to reconcile universal values as democracy, socialism, and liberalism with the idea of a racist ethnic state. They didn't succeed, but at least they attempted. And they created at least a democracy for the Jews in Israel, if not for the Palestinians in it. And they were already losing the battle before the 7th of October 2020. And the events of the 7th of October and after that do not help the chances of success. In fact, it led to a huge immigration. We don't know the numbers, but hundreds of thousands of what I call the State of Israel residents, if you want, with their money, because they have dual nationality, because they have jobs that they can ignite elsewhere. So all of it creates not only a kind of a cold civil war, it creates a vacuum in the elite. And in fact, the only bastion remaining that the state of Judea hasn't taken over is the judicial system. But they are doing their best now to complete the mission there as well.
Which is why we saw protests over the past several, certainly even before October 7th, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the kind of secular state of Israel, so to speak, realized that this is the last battle. I mean, if they take over the judicial system, not much is left for the others.
How did Israel get to this point? I mean, we often hear it described as the most far-right government. Of course, Netanyahu's been around for, you know, three decades in one form or another. How did Israel get to this point?
Well, I think the problem was that what the old Israel offered was impossible. You cannot square the circle. You cannot really create a state that is both Jewish and democratic, because the only definition that they had of Judaism was an ethnic definition, which meant that the ethnicity of the state did not respect or did not represent, first of all, 20% of the people who were not Jewish, secondly, did not represent the millions of people that Israel kicked out of Palestine in 1948, and did not resolve the issue that was at the very heart of Zionism, namely the imposition of a European Jewish state on the heart of the Arab world at the expense of the Palestinians. So all these attempts, eventually by the Israeli Jewish electorate, were seen as not leading to any kind of resolution. Israel needed to continue and police by force millions of Palestinians, a situation that not so dramatically as it happened in the last 2 years, but incrementally eroded the legitimacy of the state, eroded the support among Jews and others to the idea of Israel. The international community began to, you know, to pay attention in the 1990s and ever since then to the constant violation of human rights and civil rights by Israel. So there was no dividends from this game, and I think there was an exhaustion in the Jewish society. You cheat yourself, you cheat the world, and eventually it doesn't really work. So I think that's one major reason for that. The second reason is, of course, the cycle of violence, because once you violently invade the country and there is a reaction, the reaction is not always non-violent. It's violent as well. And this cycle that once the resistance to your wish to dispossess the people is an armed struggle or a guerrilla warfare, the reaction of the state is even more severe and violent. And in turn, that creates another more vicious, if you want, of bloodshed and violence. So it's easy to convince the population that this is life. There's no other option. The only option is to kill, to wound, to fight, to genocide, and so on. Unfortunately, we didn't have the right people who would show the courage and lead a different kind of a movement and say, well, the conclusion from that reality is that the idea of a Jewish state is the problem here. And there are alternatives which are more humane, that most people in the world cherish in their own countries, which is a purely democratic country, and not an ethnic racist country. But that, when that choice had to be made between, are you willing to be a real democracy, or do you want to be actually an apartheid racist state? Unfortunately, most of the Jews voted in one way or another for the latter option, because the first option means giving up all the privileges, the land, the resources, everything you robbed from the indigenous people, and you don't want to give them back unless you are forced to do so.
Yeah, and forcing it has been a big challenge, which I think brings me to the next point. And you rightly identified that, of course, the global opinion of Israel is rapidly shifting. And you dedicate in the Israel lobby several chapters to explaining how the pro-Israel advocacy networks, or AIPAC in short, especially in the US and UK, have shaped public discourse and foreign policy. So can you tell us about those networks and what impact they've actually had on US in particular, but of course UK as well as foreign policy?
Yes. First of all, we have to appreciate the longevity of this effort. It starts very early on, in around 1900, becomes already quite an impressive...
That's how thick the book is, to dive into it.
So it's a more than a century of advocacy, and one should not underestimate the importance of experience. If you exist for such a long time, of course, as the year passed by, you are much more experienced, and you already have an aura of a very powerful organization that you better not deal with. You do what they want, even if they don't approach you directly or threaten you directly. So I think it's important to understand that from the very beginning, I think, Zionist ideologues and leaders understood that there was a moral issue. There was a moral problem with the idea that the only solution for the European racism towards Jews was to impose the Jewish state on the Arab world to the extent of the Palestinians. They understood that this was something that in a world that began to talk about decolonization, a world especially after the Second World War, talked about human rights, had the Human Rights Declaration in 1948, created the United Nations and wanted to protect people from further oppression, a world that wanted to prevent a Third World War given the horrific consequences of the two first, well, the First and Second World War. In that world, however you presented the Zionist project, it was a project of dispossession and elimination of the native people. Even when good intentions were part of it, as long as you were loyal to the idea that this has to be a Jewish state, there was no way of respecting the new universal code, moral code that the world, especially the West, pretended to adopt. It adopted it in a very exceptional, hypocritical way, but that's another story. In any case, so the advocacy had to take into account, I think for very, very early on, and I show it in the book, that they have very little chance of winning the moral debate. That, if you want, the facts were on the side of the Palestinians. The truth was on the side of the Palestinians. So what do? You need an advocacy that is much more a structure of coercion, maybe temptation, sometimes pressure, in order to make sure that the people with power would see it in their interest to support you. Maybe some of them would be convinced morally, you know, ideologically, that what you do is fine. And I think at the beginning, it was a bit easier for the lobby, because you could convince American white settlers that white Jewish settlers have the right to settle someone else's, colonize someone else's homeland, also Australian, could be easily convinced by that. All three settler colonial projects definitely supported each other morally, despite the injustice that was integral part of their project. You could convince Christian Zionists that this is a project that would lead to the resurrection of the dead, the return of Jesus, and so on. And then also convince the West that this is a Western democracy in a sea of Arab and Islamic barbarism. The problem was for the lobby that as we move from 48 and we reach 1967, and the occupation is far more transparent and exposed to everyone to see and understand, it's much more difficult to build a moral justification for the daily oppression of the Palestinians. And that's when the lobby begins to use the tactics of, as I said, inducement and coercion. And it's very effective. It knows how to do it. It companies politicians in Britain and in the United States from very early stages in their careers, so that they would be committed to the cause when they begin their political career, and then you can ask for the dividends or for the payback later on if they reach a more powerful position. You destroy politicians if they dare to challenge the lobby, you use money, power, clout, political clout, and of course, as I said before, the cycle of violence, the way the Palestinian resistance developed, objectively here and there, helped the lobby to say, "You see, who we're dealing with?
We're dealing with terrorists."
The terrorists, exactly. 9/11 was the point that everybody thought this would be the most successful moment of the lobby, that they would associate 9/11 with Palestine. They didn't take into account that already in 2001, in 9/11, the civil society, even in the United States, were far more knowledgeable, far more sophisticated, and understood very well that you cannot compare the Palestinian resistance and anti-colonialist struggle for freedom and liberation with the acts of terrorism committed by Al-Qaeda on the American soil, and that is something the lobby doesn't know how to deal with ever since. Yeah.
As in the civil society piece.
Yeah, the civil society, the fact that the internet allows far more information and knowledge, the Z generation, Generation Z, and even the one before it, are curious people, are alert to fake news, to fabrication. We call them naive, but they do understand who is a victim and who is a victimizer. We saw it in the demonstration in the US and elsewhere, in Italy in particular, for instance. They are not mesmerized by the main shield of immunity Israel provides, which is to say it's a very complicated and only a complicated issue, and we are the only ones who really understand it, and you have to listen to our... Yeah, so, and they don't buy it anymore. And the lobby doesn't know what to do with it, you know? Yeah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is modesty? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shredder with me, Sister Zainab. And look, modesty is something that for sure I've talked about, and it is also something that again and again is very topical. So whether we're in a Muslim-majority country, outside of a Muslim-majority country, now for us as Muslims, it's something that is a topic that we sort of need to consider much more in a sense. And modesty, obviously modesty is not just a particular way of dressing. Modesty concerns our behavior. Modesty concerns maybe how we mix with other people who are, for example, not on mahram. Modesty concerns how we, the sorts of words we say, whether we use bad words when we're speaking with other people. So all this sort of comes into it. Modesty can also be, in a sense, whether we are have airs of superiority or arrogance towards others. So there's also an element of humility that comes in there. But maybe just to sort of give you an idea of some of the things we could be talking about, I'll just mention something from life of one of the famous martyrs of the Holy Defense, by the name of Ibrahim Hadi. So as an example, so Ibrahim Hadi always lowered his gaze. So even when there was a woman that came to his family house to visit, for example, with his mother, he would look down. And to some extent, people, and he was very protective of sort of the women in his house. So for example, I've read that people didn't even realize that he had a sister until afterwards, because he was very protective that his sister would sort of, in a sense, be sort of sheltered and not exposed to having to meet with sort of non-mahram in the house. So obviously, so what do we, and there's other aspects here, so what else can we say about modesty? Welcome back to AIDS here on Iron Wings Radio, me Sister Zainab. And so I've just sketched out some of the things that immediately come to mind when we're talking about modesty. I've given the example of Ibrahim Hadi, who was very careful towards sort of women who came visiting his mother in his family house, for example, and would always lower his gaze. And, you know, and then there's the other aspect to modesty, because, you know, when it comes to the topic of modesty, sometimes we can also rush to assumptions, because we could, for example, rush to assumptions that if someone's dressed in a particular way, maybe they're more modest, and maybe some of us are even judgmental. And this is obviously one of the things I want to just sort of map out that we need to be aware of. If we think too much of ourselves, too highly of ourselves, if, for example,